Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This may or may not make you feel better, but those rising oil prices, 101.32, the high today, that's not why your wallet's feeling lighter. Don't blame food either, because everything is more expensive. Core inflation is the phrase of the day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today is the 20th of February. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. Every time consumer inflation statistics come out from the Department of Labor, and that happens once a month, we actually get two numbers. The first is a reflection of all the prices the government measures: housing, food, cars, the whole deal. The other is what's called the core rate, and that's the one economists pay the most attention to because it leaves out food and energy. Yes, we all eat and use electricity, but those prices change so much they're not really useful as a way to measure inflation trends. Anyway, today we learned the overall consumer price index was up 0.4% in January. Worse, that the core rate was just 0.1% lower, which means higher prices are spreading into the broader economy. We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale, how come?
Like many of our manufactured goods these days, a lot of our inflation is imported. Higher labor costs in countries like China, along with rising demand for raw materials, are making traditionally cheap items like clothing more expensive for the first time in more than a decade. Economist Joel Naroff at Commerce Bancorp says as the dollar fell, importers had to pay more for goods manufactured overseas.
Foreign producers had been doing their best to hold out and not raise prices in the U.S., but now we're beginning to see that they're doing that, and that's why there's more concern now than there had been about inflation.
On the domestic side, a jump in healthcare costs contributed to January's spike in core inflation. With the annual rate running at 2.5%, the Federal Reserve Board is in a tough spot. To ease the credit crunch, the Fed wants to lower interest rates, but that puts more money in the economy, stoking inflation. The Fed is counting on a slowing economy to ease inflationary pressures, and Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says that could happen.
But people shouldn't get that happy about it, because the main way in which a weaker economy is going to slow inflation is by weakening wage growth. You know, we might see somewhat lower inflation if, you know, we see the unemployment rate rise and wages grow less rapidly, but, you know, the other side of that story is that most of us are going to see our income grow less rapidly as well.
For now, Baker says recession, not inflation, remains the bigger threat to the U.S. economy. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Picking up on that recession thought, we got the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee's most recent meeting today. And based on the mood around the big conference table last month, it looks like there's a good chance of another interest rate cut when they meet again on the 18th of March. On the not-so-good side, the Fed has cut its estimate of economic growth. Gross domestic product, Fed says, should rise something less than 2% this year. Whatever the Fed says, more of us think we have slipped into a recession already. According to a Zogby poll out this morning, 54% of Americans think the economy's already gone under. If you've been paying attention to your cell phone bill, you know inflation came to mobile prices long ago. But for the really big talkers among us, that trend might be heading the other way. Yesterday, Verizon unveiled a flat-rate calling plan for $99 a month. And that's just the beginning. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin dials into the latest round of cell phone price wars.
There are several theories about why Verizon shook things up with a flat mobile rate. One is that Sprint had already begun testing a similar plan. Another is the iPhone effect. Verizon has been losing customers to AT&T and the iPhone. But industry analyst Scott Ellison with IDC says the real reason is market saturation.
Now that 80% of all Americans have a cell phone, there are fewer and fewer new subscribers to sign up. So now people are looking for ways to attract other subscribers.
A $99 plan may be a tough sell, though. Few people spend that much on voice each month. But the plans might appeal to anyone who's been hit with overage fees. Those outrageous bills for going over your minutes. Telecom exec Daniel Berninger says the extra charges make flat rates more attractive.
Even if people aren't necessarily spending that much, they may be inclined to take these plans just for the peace of mind. So we're starting at $100 plans, and then the next guy is going to introduce the $80 plan, et cetera, et cetera.
With top wireless firms offering similar voice plans, Scott Ellison with IDC says the competition now moves to text messaging and internet access.
The main battle for subscribers is now probably going to shift from voice plans, because now everyone's offering the same thing, to the data plan.
T-Mobile is offering unlimited text messaging with its $99 plan, and Sprint's test plan at $120 includes email, messaging, and web use. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Cell phone companies aren't the only ones changing the way they do business. In the wake of the writer's strike, changes are coming to television, too. NBC is getting ready for a new way to schedule its must-see TV. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has a preview.
The idea of a fall TV season is as old as the medium itself, and it's about as dated as a black and white television.
It's such a holdover from an earlier age that it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
That's former producer Jonathan Taplin of the University of Southern California Annenberg School. He says NBC is switching to a staggered schedule where it launches new shows year-round. It's all about appealing to advertisers. Taplin says the network will make its programs available to them earlier than rival broadcasters. That'll give marketers a chance to buy into and plan around new programs while they're being developed.
Just basically saying, here's the panoply of stuff we do that you can buy. And that's a smart thing to do.
James McQuivey of Forrester Research says it's also a necessary thing to do for the network's survival.
The consumers have changed. The advertisers want to get in front of them. And NBC is thinking, well, this is a way to satisfy the advertisers who want to reach the consumers. Everybody is hopefully going to be happier as a result.
NBC insists this doesn't mean advertisers are going to start deciding what shows you see on television. TV columnist Tim Goodman of the San Francisco Chronicle doesn't buy that.
We are already in a world where product integration is just part of the game now for television series.
With ratings tanking and viewers skipping commercials or television altogether, what advertisers want is likely what they're going to get. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Investors ate it up when those Fed minutes were released this afternoon because, you know, nothing gets Wall Street going like the prospect of a good rate cut. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If the New York Times is to be believed, this week could bring the next step in Microsoft's bid for Yahoo. The paper says Microsoft is set to launch a proxy fight and win control that way. They've got to do it that way because Yahoo's board rejected the offer from Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer a couple of weeks ago. Rather than try to decipher some obscure Securities and Exchange Commission filing to figure out how it all might play out, we've decided to do things the easy way, and we've called James Brock at Miami University of Ohio. He teaches mergers and acquisitions there. Professor Brock, good to have you with us.
Good to talk with you.
What exactly does it mean when a company says it's going to launch a proxy fight?
Well, it means that it's going to go around the management of a company and appeal directly to the shareholders to sell to the firm that wants to acquire them, typically against the wishes of the management.
All right, well, let's say I hold some Yahoo stock and Microsoft comes knocking on my door. What are they going to do for me?
Well, they're going to try to persuade you that you will be financially better off if you sell your stock to Microsoft at the price they're offering than if you hang on to it. In other words, they're going to claim you get your money now and you're going to get more money now than you would if you just hung on and stuck with Yahoo.
The initial offer price was $31 a share. Could I expect to see a bump in that?
You might well. You might well because they have to go against the headwind of the opposition of Yahoo's management, so they might try to sweeten the offer a little bit for the stockholders.
What's Yahoo management's counter going to be to me? Are they going to come to me with a mailing that says, listen, we're going to increase your stock price by doing X, Y, and Z?
They, that's essentially what they would do. They would make the opposite argument that you will be better off if you sit with us and stay where you are rather than sell out to Microsoft. And sometimes firms will even promise a little bit extra dividend to try to sweeten the pot.
If I'm a disgruntled Yahoo shareholder, though, all I'm going to do is look back and say, yeah, but the share price so far isn't doing so well, which is part of why you got in trouble in the first place.
And then you would take the offer from Microsoft and be a happy fellow.
That's right. Now, do these kinds of appeals directly to shareholders typically work?
It depends. It depends on Yahoo and what it's been doing and what people think its prospects are under the management that exists. It also depends on how concentrated ownership of shares is in some institutions that may own large blocks of shares in Yahoo and how amenable they are to selling out.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. Large institutional shareholders, it would seem to me, would have a greater say than somebody just with a couple of hundred Yahoo shares.
Absolutely, and that would be who Microsoft would really concentrate on persuading to sell.
Can they wrap this up then by going to a couple of mutual funds and proxy firms and doing it that way?
Well, it'd probably be more than a couple. I don't have any idea what the ownership of Yahoo stock is, but they would certainly concentrate on large block owners and give them a great deal of attention, yeah.
Does this possible proxy fight, because it hasn't really been announced yet, does it denote that Microsoft is really serious about this? I mean, it's not cheap to do all this stuff.
No, it's not, and Microsoft is not living hand-to-mouth either, so they certainly have the resources to launch this kind of battle. So if they are this determined, they certainly have the financial wherewithal to make a run of it.
James Brock is a professor of economics at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Professor Brock, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
You know all those half-full prescription bottles that have been in your medicine cabinet forever? Did you ever wonder what you're supposed to do with them? A lot of people apparently have found a solution because modern medicines are increasingly ending up in wastewater. That water flows out to rivers and oceans, and it's given rise to what's being called pharma pollution. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
When scientists find trace amounts of Lipitor or Celebrex in wastewater, they know the drugs got there one of two ways, through normal human excretion or by consumers following orders and flushing leftover meds down the toilet.
Which is what most doctors were telling folks.
That's Joel Kreisberg, director of a green pharmacy program in Berkeley. Kreisberg says we can't do much about Mother Nature, but we can stop flushing those old pills away. Studies suggest a third of consumers do it, encouraged in part perhaps by long-standing advice from poison control centers. Kreisberg has started one of a dozen drug take-back programs in the U.S., a practice that's already routine in Europe and parts of Canada.
We've taken back 700 pounds in 6 months.
Under this program, at least a dozen participating pharmacies and clinics are now collecting their customers' unused prescription drugs. Kreisberg's nonprofit has been footing the bill, but as the program's grown, he's begun asking new participants to help pay for it. The meds have to be shipped to an outfit in Texas that not only incinerates the drugs, it also documents exactly what kind.
So the most common drug that we took back out of our sample was psychotherapeutic agents, which was 25%.
Think Zoloft and other mood enhancers. Antidepressants are some of the compounds found in treated wastewater. Scientists have also discovered trace amounts of everything from ibuprofen to antibiotics. Dana Culpin of the U.S. Geological Survey says the government is just beginning to study the effects of this drug cocktail on marine life, and we don't know a lot yet, but the risks of not finding out are huge.
We're talking worst-case scenarios, but it could be that, you know, maybe there is actual effects to fish populations. So each generation is getting subtly whacked, and at so many generations may come to the point where the population crashes. They just no longer have the ability to reproduce, either for one reason or the other.
So if you have any medications that you'd like to bring in, just let us know.
At a pharmacy in North Berkeley, it's news to some customers that drugs are ending up in rivers and oceans.
I've not read that. I'm not surprised to hear that's the case.
The idea is to get consumers to think of old pills as hazardous waste, just like lead batteries or old paint. Some cities have sponsored drug take-back events and collected bagfuls of people's pills, like So Much Good and Plenty. The government now recommends using take-back programs if available, but there are obstacles. Federal drug laws prohibit most of these programs from collecting prescribed narcotics, and pharmaceutical companies don't support takebacks.
We think that's a solution that's actually looking for a problem.
Marjorie Powell represents the industry's main lobbying group. Powell says, one, pill flushing is a minor contributor to pharmaceuticals in the waterways. Two, she argues, consumers can safely dispose of unused drugs by throwing them in the garbage in tightly sealed containers.
Therefore, we think that focusing on creating a take-back program is establishing an enormous level of effort for very little return.
But tossing drugs in the trash still carries safety and environmental risks. Advocates like Kreisberg say takebacks are important and hope drug companies will eventually be forced to pay for them, like in Europe. He says the ultimate solution, of course, is for all of us to take better care of ourselves, so we need fewer drugs. The average senior takes between 2 and 7 prescriptions a day. In Berkeley, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, scarce solutions in Kenya.
When somebody is hungry, you don't start telling the person things will work out in a year's time and the person is hungry now.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 0.7% today, 90 points to close at 12,427. The Nasdaq rose 0.9%, 20 points, met the bell at 2327. The S&P 500 picked up 0.6%, 8 points to end the day at 1357. We told you about those pricing wars in the mobile phone industry. Well, the big carriers went on the fritz today. AT&T dialed down 4.25%. Sprint Nextel lost more than 5.5%. Hewlett-Packard shot up almost 8% after it beat estimates in the first quarter. The world's largest PC maker also expects to have a banner year overseas. Winn-Dixie headed north 11.5%. The supermarket chain lifted its 2008 earnings forecast. Markets overseas were hit kind of hard. Britain's FTSE stumbled 1.25%. France's CAC 40 and Germany's DAX both fell 1.5%. Back home, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. By Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by Medtronic, recruiting runners who benefit from medical technology to run in Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon events. More at Medtronic.com/globalheroes. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to Marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its latest index of leading economic indicators. President and Mrs. Bush wrap up their trip to Africa with a stop in Liberia before returning to the White House. And Senators Clinton and Obama get some FaceTime debating in Austin ahead of the next round of primaries. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Another big acquisition fell apart today, and the credit squeeze had nothing at all to do with it. Back in September, the private equity group Bain Capital offered $2.2 billion for 3Com, the network equipment maker. Trouble was, 20% of the purchase price would have come from a Chinese company, Huawei Technologies. The prospect that Huawei might get its hands on some sensitive technology didn't sit too well with the federal agency that gets to decide those kinds of things, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, it's called. Commentator Robert Reich says it's time America decides what the phrase sensitive technology really means.
Which is more important, exporting our technologies or preventing foreigners from getting access to them? Apparently, the U.S. government has no idea. Its left and right hands are moving in opposite directions. On the one hand, the Commerce Department is busy trying to revive the White House's free trade agenda by relaxing restrictions on some militarily sensitive exports. The president even issued a directive streamlining export regulations on products that include military and so-called dual-use technologies that might have military uses, things like aircraft parts and computer equipment. American exporters have been complaining that the old process, requiring them to get a license each time they want to sell these sorts of things, is just too cumbersome and was hurting their businesses. Under the streamlined system, foreign buyers can be cleared in advance. Five Chinese companies have already been pre-cleared to buy some American products with potential military uses. Okay, so we're exporting more military-related technologies to China, right? No! With the other hand, the Justice Department and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies have been cracking down on such exports. Just last week, the Justice Department charged a former Boeing engineer with turning over trade secrets to China. In the fiscal year that ended September 30th, the number of people charged with violating export control laws was up 50% from a year earlier. The crackdown has already endangered several global deals. Now, it's not unusual for different parts of our government to move at cross purposes. And when it comes to China, policymakers have been debating for years over whether to make trade or national security the driving force. But now we have two initiatives heading in diametrically opposite directions, and the result is confusion, waste, and lots more work for Washington lawyers. Now, it may be a wild suggestion, but why can't the government just distinguish between militarily sensitive American technologies that must not be exported at all and technologies whose export would benefit both the United States and foreign nations?
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Supercapitalism. Send us your thoughts if you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Reconciliation talks in Kenya have come to a delicate moment. Opposition leaders in Nairobi said today they'll start up street protests again next week if the government doesn't make some concrete concessions. Protests and ethnic violence that started after the elections back in December have led to more than 1,000 deaths so far. Perhaps a 500,000 people have been driven from their homes. Kenya's main industries, tourism and agriculture, have slim hopes for profits in the next few months, and people have had to leave behind their businesses to save their lives. From Nairobi, Sarah Nix reports.
Enos Robinson says Jamhuri Park is supposed to be a place of business, not a place of refuge. The bespectacled young Luo man says he finds it hard to believe that his family is now living with hundreds of other displaced Kenyans. They're camped on grounds that are best known for hosting the annual International Trade Fair. 26-year-old Robinson says he used to wake up early every morning to tend to his own business, a wholesale food shop in the Rift Valley town of Thika.
That shop of mine, it was my father, it was my mother. It is the place I was getting the daily food of mine.
Robinson says he's spent the past 6 years growing the business from a meager investment of about $75 to an inventory worth about $1,500. He says his good business sense enabled him to net about $30 a day. The average daily wage in Kenya is about $1.50 U.S. He reinvested half the profits in the business. The other half supported his wife and child. But all that changed in early February during the latest wave of violence in Thika.
When I went out, I looked from a distance to my place. I could see many guys carrying my own thing. But nothing I could have done. All had gone. And it's like, when the milk pour down, you cannot recollect it.
Robinson says, like many of the Luos who've left the Rift Valley, he will return to his rural home. There, he will try to start all over again. Patrick Gathitu Kariuki is a Kikuyu businessman from the Rift Valley town of Eldoret. He and his family fled to Nairobi to escape attacks that are part of a long-standing land dispute in the area. Kariuki left behind a flour mill, a hotel, rental properties, and another business which he says was his particular passion. About 6 years ago, he and his wife started a project to develop and sell inexpensive tools. The goal? To improve the lives of people living in poverty in rural Kenya.
Simple technology that can assist somebody, like example, draw water. All that we do to try and alleviate poverty, that's where my passion is. My heart, believe me or not, had given to the same people who don't want to see me in the region.
Kariuki hired out the manufacturing work to local people who had small cottage industries. With no business in the area now, he says, those people have no income. Kariuki says he can't go back to Eldoret. He will try to sell his properties in the Rift Valley to raise enough money to move the small tools business to Nairobi. That means laying off 20 staff people in the Rift Valley, which, he says, will add to the poverty in the area. That, in turn, will feed the violence.
These are not high-income earners. Within a very short time, they'll be in a very desperate situation. When somebody is hungry, you don't start telling the person things will work out in a year's time and the person is hungry now. It will take anything for desperate people to spark another spate of violence.
He'd like to keep his business in Eldoret, but for now, Kariuki says he does not see an end to the cycle of vengeance. He says displaced business people in Kenya have little choice but to sell any remaining property. They must start fresh in a location where their tribal affiliations don't put their lives or their livelihoods at risk. In Nairobi, I'm Sarah Nix for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, mostly for the parents of really smart high schoolers. Stanford has joined the parade of upper-tier universities cutting costs for middle-class families. The school announced today it'll cover tuition for students whose families earn less than $100,000 a year. Households with incomes of $60,000 or less will get room and board, too. For the 2008-2009 school year at Leland Stanford Junior University, that's a $47,000 value. Only one caveat for all you hopefuls out there. Of the 22,000 or so kids that applied last year, the school says about 2,000 got in. So, you know, no pressure. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow rose 90 points, 7-tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 9-tenths percent. The S&P 500 bumped up 8.6 tenths of 1% there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole M. Bornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, developing prototypes for profit.
The market wanted page views, and the market wanted eyeballs. And everything the market rewarded, we learned very, very well how to make.
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time with Bill Gross, the CEO of Idea Lab. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.